Hi, everybody. Welcome to Beyond the Matrix, the program that asks you to think outside the box of convention and get in touch with the higher wisdom that you hold within you and that you receive from beyond. We have an interesting show tonight with Asha Prabhu, who is a teacher of Swami Kriyananda. Have I got that right?
You got it right, all of it.
Who was a disciple of the famous guru Paramhansa Yogananda. We'll be talking with her in a moment, but before we get started, I would like to answer the questions that all of you are asking me about my time at Abydos. At the moment, I'm not really prepared to discuss this on the radio because there's so much to filter through. So it will come up soon. Hang in there. I have plenty to tell you, and I know that you're waiting to hear about that. Okay, so let's get on with the... First of all, Asha, welcome. It's a delight and an honor to have you on the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
Thank you. I understood that you were very busy this morning, so I'm grateful that you managed to find time to join us.
Well, this is another moment now, and we have nothing to do but do this, and I'm very happy to be with you.
Wonderful. So you're from the Bay Area, which is my home as well, and... Your organization is Ananda, that's correct?
Yes, Ananda. We have Ananda communities in seven different communities around the world.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you began this work with, how you got involved with Ananda, about your meeting with Swami Kriyananda in 1969 is probably a good place to start.
Sure, it's always started at the beginning.
Swami Kriyananda... if there is a beginning.
If there is. The beginning of this chapter, I think, is the way to
okay.
Swami Kriyananda is an American. He has an Indian name which was given to him by his guru. Kriyananda is still living. He'll be 81 this spring. Kriyananda was a direct disciple of Paramhansa Yogananda. Many people have read Autobiography of a Yogi. It's
indeed
one of the most influential spiritual books of our time. Kriyananda was 22 years old in 1948. This was long before these things were so common. He read Autobiography of a Yogi, and immediately Kriyananda was in New York. He went to Los Angeles, where Yogananda was still living. His first words he spoke to Yogananda were, "I want to be your disciple." And from that day to this, which has been 60 years, he's dedicated his life 100% to serving his guru's work, to teaching Kriya Yoga, to training disciples, to writing books, and so on. Well, I was 22 in 1969, as it happened, and I was also a very serious seeker without any sense of how that seeking would ever become grounded in some actual way of living. I was reading voraciously, especially books along the Eastern tradition, and then I started reading books about saints and gurus, looking for some way to translate idealism into real life. But everything I read was so far from my actual experience, you know, taking care of lepers in the Middle Ages or living isolated life in a Himalayan cave or entering a Catholic convent. And I was a young Jewish girl, and that was hardly an option for me. But I was living in San Francisco. I was quietly desperate, because I was grown up enough to see that this is what other people considered to be adult life, and I could tell it wasn't going to work for me. And right into that, I met Swami Kriyananda. He was actually giving, by then I was living on the peninsula in Palo Alto, California, where Stanford University is. I had attended Stanford, but I never graduated because it just didn't give me what I wanted. But Kriyananda had been invited to lecture there, and a friend of mine suggested that I would enjoy it, so I went. And I literally, I mean, I it sounds a little irresponsible, but since it was now 40 unchanged years ago nearly, it's not irresponsible in fact. But I was sitting in it was actually an outdoor tent, and Kriyananda walked in. And he just walked in, and I could intuitively sense that everything that I was trying to find out how to do, he had turned it into a practical life. He had made spiritual idealism a way of life, and I could feel that he had what I wanted. In fact, that's literally the words that came into my mind. He was standing in front of me, hadn't spoken a word. It was this room full of maybe 200 people, and the thought came in my mind, he has what I want. And he walked into the room. He took his place on the auditorium stage. And in that instant, I just knew this was my destiny. And it proved to be so. And he was starting a rural community. He was just beginning what has become Ananda, with the first community up in near Grass Valley, California. It was almost literally bare land. It was just a vision in his own consciousness. And very quickly, I just threw my lot in with his and sold everything I had and went up to that rural community. And, well, here I am 40 years later. I helped start that one, which is Ananda Village, which is really one of the most successful spiritual communities in the world. And then 15 or 16 years later, by then I was married to my husband, David Praver, and he and I came together to Palo Alto, and we've started a second community for Ananda here. And most recently, in all those years of being with Swami, and this is the quick summary and then we can go back, I always felt that I was witness to something that was intended to be more than just for me. So from very early on, and I was Swami's secretary, and for many years I saw him every day and worked very closely with him, and I took many notes of the time we had together, and then later I interviewed others, and recently, in the last year, I brought out a book, which is called Swami Kriyananda As We Have Known Him, and it's firsthand accounts, mostly my own, but also the accounts of others, of the practical everyday reality of living with a person who is a disciple of a great master and who has dedicated his life to that kind of service. And
in fact, I'm holding the book now in my hand and want to thank you for sending me the copy. It's an incredible book, and it's going to take much more time than I thought to go through it, because I want to savor the wisdom and the simplicity of the message. But I would like to, before we go on, I would like to be able to tell readers how they can get their hands on this book. I see that got the publisher's name. Would that do it?
You can go to a website called doormyheart.com.
Okay.
And that'll take you right to the page where you can order the book, doorofmyheart.com. It's also available.
Okay, that's www.doorofmyheart.com.
Right.
So please jot that down, listeners, as we walk through this interview with Asha.
You can also go to any of the conventional booksellers online or bricks and mortar, and almost all of them are carrying it now. So Kriyananda, Asha Praver will get you to the book.
I see. So are you still working directly with Swami Kriyananda?
Yes, except that he lived in India and I live in California, and then he lived in Italy and I lived in California. So after the late 80s, we've been living in different communities and even on different continents, but I'm in touch with him many times during the week and through email and world travel and telephone. And, of course, more subtle ways of being connected. The relationship has remained and deepened over all these years. And what I was writing in this book is there's a tremendous interest, natural interest, in finding a spiritual teacher, a mentor, an older brother, just someone who's a good friend, someone who has your genuine spiritual interests at heart, and has the ability consistently over time to act wisely and selflessly for the sake of your well-being. And, you know, there's been, over the 40 years I've been in this, there have been lots of rising and falling tides of enthusiasm for gurus and masters and so on. But the essential truth of the need for that relationship is profound. And yet, in our culture, it's not well understood. And one of the things I really wanted to put forth in this book is, what is the nature of a true teacher, and what is the nature of a true relationship with a true teacher? It's not nearly as otherworldly as people imagine it to be. There's an extremely day-to-day pragmatic aspect of it that is really the doorway to those bigger realities, but it's a very grounded, very recognizable experience, and I wanted to help bring that whole relationship into a more mature focus.
And I think that one of the things that strikes me right away of the teachings that you're bringing forth in this book is the sense of understanding to be in egolessness. And this is something that I think is the quintessence of spirit, knowing how to get out of your own way, whether you're the teacher or the student.
That's exactly right. Ego is the ego is the constricting force. And in
most
fact,
definitely.
Yeah. In fact, as I look back on my own life, I never expected, I wasn't looking for God as a child. I had no particular thought of God ever. I came first to the Eastern understanding of spirit, which was more to my liking. To find myself, even in my 20s, you know, living such a devotional life was really a surprise to me. But when I looked back, I realized it was just a matter of vocabulary. Because what I always felt, even from a very young age, was confined. I felt so confined. And I couldn't articulate it until I found other people's words to put an understanding on what that feeling was. But because I was very talented, but I had no ambition. Because every possible venue of success in life looked to me like at the end of it, I would still be me, and that wouldn't really solve the problem. It was only when I understood the possibility of ego transcendence, or even a more practical way to put it, is functioning through the ego, but from a sense of a greater reality. And those words translate then into the words of a devotee, of acting as a channel for God and so on. But it was such a liberating thought. And of course, what I've seen in Swami Kriyananda over all these years in the most practical way is just what that looks like when you actually live, when you actually do work, when you drive a car, when you do business, when you have to make money. How can you live through the ego but with a constant sense of transcendence at the same time?
And? Have you found that peace within you now?
I think it would be an exaggeration to say so. Am I on the right path? Do I have confidence? Am I a totally different person than I was when I started? Yes. Is there a great expanse in front of me? Yes. But
that's magnificent. How do you find, all right, I'm out of the States now for 25 years, and I am, as I told you, from the Bay Area. In fact, I lived many years in San Bruno, so we, in essence, we're pretty much neighbors.
Yes, exactly.
Watching the events that are occurring in the world now and the, shall I say, fanaticism, religious fanaticism and fervor that has overtaken the U.S., are you living comfortably? Are your communities comfortable, or do you feel pressure from this new, how shall I say it without being offensive?
Do we feel threatened by the strong-minded attitudes of others who may have power?
Well, I don't think you're going to feel threatened because of the essence of the teachings. But what I'm trying to find out here is, how does your society or your community interact with this new? It's a new America.
Well, yes, I'm sure you see it even more strongly. I believe you live in Italy now, is that right, in Europe?
Yes, I'm in Italy, and we, I wouldn't say we get freer news, but, you know, if you observe what's going on, you observe the political statements from all of the people that are trying to manipulate and maneuver themselves in that venue, and there's definitely an absolute. Is there such a word as zealotism?
Well, you know, Paramahansa Yogananda wrote about this. Yogananda wrote about it. Kriyananda's written about it subsequently. And they take it from a huge perspective, and that perspective is really cosmic cycles of time, which I know is something you're familiar with. In India, it's called yugas, which means great ages. I believe you were recently in Egypt, and, you know, you're looking there at civilizations that inhabited this same physical space with us, but obviously from a very different state of consciousness than the planet has at this time. And Yogananda writes extensively about the fact that this planet is in a shift. Now, there's two dramas that take place. One drama is what is happening in terms of the planet itself, and the theory of the yugas is the theory that many cultures put forward, that there are four great ages of time, when you call them, you know, silver, gold, bronze, whatever you call them. In India, they're called the material age, the age of energy, the age of consciousness, the age of spirit, Kali, Dwapara, Treta, Satya, the age of truth. Anyway, But the point is that the planet itself, and the way Yogananda explains it fascinatingly, is that it's actually an astrological, astronomical phenomenon of the actual movement of the planet closer and farther away from the source of energy of this particular galaxy in which we live, that we've been farther away from that source, and now the planet is moving closer to the source. So the actual vibrations on this physical plane are rising. Now, the drama of the individual soul through its evolution through many incarnations, well, the jiva, the individual that it represents that soul, expresses that soul, the drama of the individual through incarnations happens on many different planets. You're not just stuck as an earthling and have to just be here forever waiting for it to evolve. The soul goes, the individual goes to whatever planets suit its vibration and give it the lessons that it needs. Well, having said all of that, according to this tradition, which is a fascinating theory because it makes so much more sense than these linear concepts of history, this is a circular rise and fall over 24,000 years. The nadir was 500 A.D., and right at 1900, there was a huge transition from the material age into the age of energy. And, you know, look how our world has changed in this 100-plus century. But what that is there's a huge shift that has to take place between that very fixed material tradition and this rising new understanding. And right now, what we're witnessing, and according to all the masters' predictions from every angle, it's going to get worse before it gets better. Is this this strong, entrenched, matter-defined sense of reality, which translates as religious fanaticism, as dogmatism, as looking to fixed form, versus this energy concept of the universe, this consciousness concept of the universe. And society is heading upward in consciousness, but it's not going to get there without some kind of a struggle. And you and I and all the rest of us who are doing this other kind of work are essentially laying the groundwork. But the power is more in the hands right now. The visible power is more in the hands of the energy from the past, more matter-oriented, sensually indulgent, dogmatically fixed. And yes, there will be some kind of a conflict. And I mean, I use the word threatened. I think the time will come when right now, the more fanatical forms don't consider us much of a threat. They don't see us as being anything really to worry about. The time could come when they recognize that what we represent is really the antithesis of what they're doing, but they don't see that yet. Whether or not that will result in making our lives, you know, less outwardly secure or not, it really doesn't make any difference because we have to do what we have to do, and we have to do it with...
And because you're inwardly secure,
I
would have to say. I mean, I don't know how bad things are in the States, but you can certainly get a feeling for the overall energy, overlying energy in society. And if you're feeling this in California, which is one of the most liberal places
right.
in the States,
right.
I can only imagine what it's like in other places.
Well, California,
it will remain nameless.
Yeah, California is heavenly by comparison. It, you know, both the coasts of the United States and especially California are the most liberal-minded. But it's everywhere you turn. And now, you know, that kind of religious fixity is moving into the political arena, as it has been in, you know, countries that have been committed to one church for many years. The country you live in, for example, where the religious, so-called religious, the institutional religion and politics are all intertwined. And that's why, at the present moment, we're not perceived to be any kind of a threat to it, because we're just too small by comparison. But worldly power isn't everything. And
I'm sorry?
Worldly power isn't everything. There's a greater force at work here.
How do you perceive, or how do these teachings perceive 2012, of course, is on everyone's minds. We approach this date and the ending of the Mayan calendar.
Right.
Does this I don't like to be very specific about this time because I don't believe that a bell is going to ring on December 21st, 2012, and we're going to pop into another reality. Mm-hmm. But most definitely, from a pure sense of the calendar, the Mayans, which has been so accurate, running out on that date, and a lot of study of numerology and the vibrational aspects of that time frame, how does this coincide with what you're saying about the shifting of ages?
Well, it's overdue, is what I would say. Paramahansa Yogananda in the 1940s and 50s, so Kriyananda tells us, he used to, the word Swami uses, he used to thunder. He would say to people, you don't know what a terrible cataclysm is coming. And Swamiji said, that was like almost 60 years ago. He said he used to make it seem like it was coming tomorrow. Swamiji has always commented, as he puts it this way, that time is one of the most difficult aspects of prophecy, because time can be influenced by the response of individuals and the response of society. But Master was emphatic that a time of great national testing would come to the whole world. And he said specifically to America, just let me, since we've been talking about America, Yogananda said that America overall has very good karma, because of our attitude of freedom and our generosity and the fact that we were founded for religious freedom. We're alone, perhaps in the whole world, I believe, as a country that was founded specifically for religious freedom. At the same time, he said, some of that good karma, we also incurred bad karma because of the way America treated the American Indians and the way, because of slavery, because of the issue with the African American. Plus, too much materialism and greed has set into our freedom.
So plus, let's not forget that we are the only nation that ever used an atomic bomb against another nation.
Right. He said that we've incurred bad karma. He was very specific. We've incurred bad karma, he said, and therefore America will have to suffer. And because we were wrong in materialistic greed, then America will suffer a certain degree of impoverishment. In the end, he said, however, America has more good karma than bad, so it won't be destroyed. But he just spoke very explicitly, and then he just said very strongly, you must get into the light. You must practice meditation, must, in so far as they can command us to do things, but for your own well-being, you need to get into the light. You need to put your life in order so that your vibrations will be strong. And now, I mean, I've read and seen so many things about 2012, and to me it just, you just see the conflict all around you, and you hear it in the popular music, which it just sounds like it's violence itself.
Yeah, it is, and I often question whether this has been utilized purposely to lower the vibration of the planet.
Well, one great sage said, you know, that they're just sort of a, there is this door. I think that, okay, a material world, this is not a homogeneous planet. It's heterogeneous. So many different souls of different vibrations are inhabiting it together. And this has also been a good opportunity for those who like to destroy to come to a place where great change is required and to sort of act out that destructive side. And for those of us who are trying to create, it's a good challenge to our courage and our faith in God, and our ability to focus our energy inwardly and stand strong in what so far has not been really a maelstrom. But if it turns into one, then we must, or if we can mitigate it by our positive actions, this is the karmic purpose for our incarnating on this planet. Because in the end, this is just a material world. And whatever happens here, there's a cosmic destiny at work, and we're, it's our opportunity to be instruments of that destiny. I don't believe that individual egos create that destiny, but individual egos have the opportunity to choose the state of consciousness that will be the most beneficial to others and beneficial to ourselves. And if, I mean, death comes to all of us, our journey on this planet is temporary, and when we leave, all of the conditions that we're leaving behind, we just leave them behind. They disappear. We move into the astral world. But the consciousness that we acquired through the experience here is ours for eternity. And that's the level on which we have to live simultaneously on both levels, the right consciousness in response to the circumstances in which we've incarnated.
Indeed. Let me interrupt you for just a moment for people who have just tuned in, to remind you that we're speaking with Asha Prather, and she has come out with a wonderful book, the title of which is Swami Kriyananda, As We Have Known Him. And you can find this book by going to, let me hope I get this right, www.followyourheart.com.
No,
is that right?
Door of my heart.
Door of my heart.
Door of my heart.com.
Door of my heart.com.
Or go to Amazon.com or Borders or, you know, Barnes & Noble, any of them.
Okay, they can basically find it anywhere in the bookshops and on the web.
Right.
I had a question for you that completely went out of my head. Oh, here it is.
We were talking about...
Can you talk to us about... Babaji.
Say again, Babaji? Sorry,
I didn't pronounce it correctly. And I need you to speak just a little bit closer to the telephone. You're fading out.
Okay.
There you are. Great.
You asked.
Can you speak to us about this being?
The being
Babaji.
Described in Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramhansa Yogananda. It's interesting to me. People read Autobiography of a Yogi, and sometimes even more than Yogananda, they remember Babaji.
Yes.
Babaji is what Yogananda calls a deathless master, which is an individual who has chosen to use his power over time and space to maintain a physical body indefinitely, in essence, whereas most physical bodies are subject to birth and death, and most masters actually allow the body they inhabit to be subject to birth and death, even though they have the power not to have that occur. But Babaji has made the decision, partly I think just to stand as a beacon of potential for all human beings, to remain in his physical body. And Yogananda tells about him at great length in Autobiography. He lives high in the Himalayas with a band of disciples, of very advanced souls, whom he says, Yogananda says, include several Americans. Which is a charming thought, to think of someone, you know, born in Detroit, eventually now living with Babaji in the Himalayas. It puts it on a very practical level. But most importantly, Yogananda speaks of the fact that in the great cosmic plan, Babaji is one of those given an overarching responsibility for the spiritual direction of this planet, of the West, of the East. And it is through Babaji working in cooperation with Jesus, is how it's told to us in Autobiography of a Yogi, that Yogananda came to America, that Kriyananda became his disciple, that I came to Kriyananda, that this is all part of this plan emanating from these masters in the West, in the Himalayas, or in the cosmos. It's an interesting concept that everything happening that we think is emanating from politicians and nations and so on, actually everyone is just acting in accordance with higher vibrations than they themselves know, or lower vibrations, but forces beyond, again, just the human ego. Yogananda says about Babaji, one of the most thrilling promises in Autobiography of a Yogi, anyone who speaks with reverence the name Babaji attracts to himself an instant blessing. What a concept that is, isn't it?
That's wonderful.
Just sitting where we are, anywhere on the planet, if we think reverently of this great spiritual being, that his consciousness will feel that and respond to it. It's just a magnificent promise, and what an intriguing possibility to begin to experiment with, too.
Well, yes, and I've also heard that he is starting to appear to people in a community. So is he moving his physical body to these other locations, or is he appearing astrally, in your opinion?
Well, in order to be able to see Babaji, you have to have yourself a very refined level of consciousness. I know certain individuals whose bodies have born and died have claimed to be a direct incarnation of the same Babaji. By the way, Baba simply means father. And
right.
Babaji just means Reverend Father, just for the sake of the listeners.
As you refer to Swami as Swamiji?
Swamiji. J-I is, it's a very lovely suffix. It means both respect and familiarity. Affection. It's an affectionate way to refer to someone, but still respectful. In any case, Yogananda says that in order to see Babaji directly, there has to be a special purpose behind it, or a high level of spiritual evolution. But I think as people become widely more interested in this and begin sincerely to practice these teachings and more dedicated in their desire to serve the light, it would seem only natural that Babaji would be able to communicate with more souls and would want to communicate with more souls, because there's a greater receptivity to what he has to offer.
Well, yeah. In fact, if the Yogananda said that merely thinking of him will call him a blessing to you, then it's not unthinkable that meditating upon him or desiring his presence could actually manifest his presence.
It's quite possible. I mean, it's quite possible. What has happened, there are many examples in Autobiography of a Yogi, and I've heard of many stories of people who have seen him directly.
Can you tell us a story?
Well, just a young man. Well, these are, let me just say, the stories that I know are mostly not direct, I should say, because I've never actually spoken to an individual who's told me he's seen Babaji. It's more that I've heard of it. Young man.
Okay, that's okay.
But a young man just recently told Swami Kriyananda that he was walking in the mountains and Babaji came to him. And Babaji's statement to him was, in fact, it was a message for Kriyananda. It was saying that he was very grateful for the work that Kriyananda had been doing on behalf of the message, and specifically commended his work in India, and interestingly, specifically commended the fact that Kriyananda is on Indian television every day, and therefore is reaching millions of people with the message of his teachings. It tells you how directly in touch these masters are. Now, was this a true vision? I couldn't say, but the man from those who met him gave the impression that it was a true story. I met a yogi in the Himalayas last year when I was in India. We were at Badrinath, which is a place, a very holy temple, ancient holy temple that is dedicated to Babaji, in fact, to Lord Badrinath, whom many consider to have been an incarnation of Babaji. It's about 11,000 feet in the Himalayas, and we went to visit a yogi who lives in a little cottage up there, and he says that, you know, for 5 months out of the year, he leaves his physical body and goes to stay with Babaji. He kept saying in Tibet. The yogi made a very strong impression. I would have no way of judging what he was saying, but he spoke of it in the most familiar manner. Later, when I spoke to Swami Kriyananda, and Kriyananda asked me what I thought of that yogi, and I was impressed by his bright eyes and his humility. And then I said, interesting, I said, he spoke so casually, sir, of going to the Himalayas to be with Babaji. And implied in that statement was, how could you speak so casually about something so profound? Swamiji's answer was marvelous. He said back to me, he said, well, at a certain level, it just becomes your natural level of consciousness. And there's nothing really unusual about it. I thought, whoa, that is a promise worth keeping, isn't it?
It's quite incredible to speak to someone who has had this personal, a lifetime of direct work with someone, such a master teacher as Swami Kriyananda. And I have so many questions that I seem to not remember any of them. How much time have you spent then in the East?
In India?
In places like, have you been to Tibet?
No, I've never been to Tibet. I've only been to India and a little bit to Nepal, but India's the country that I visited the most. I've never lived there for any extended period of time. I've taken maybe 24 trips that would have lasted for, you know, maybe the longest trip was 6 weeks or so. My husband and I, with two of our friends, starting about 20 years ago, for a number of years, we would lead pilgrimage tours to India, and we would visit all the places, most of the places talked about in Autobiography of a Yogi, and we would visit the sites of the gurus there. We'd go a little bit into the mountains. We started going into Badrinath. Now Swami Kriyananda lives in India. He lives outside Delhi, and we're starting a community in Pune. And since he's been there, we've gone several times a year to see him. And India, to me, is more of my home than America. When I finally got to India, I felt like I was in a culture that made sense to me. The country itself of India is a very ancient culture and is undergoing a necessary modernization. So there's a lot of, just like there is in America, there's a whole lot of forces at work there. But my residence has always been in California for, you know, most of my life now. Yogananda said the best place to practice yoga in the world is California, by the way.
Why is that?
I don't know. But we who live in California are fond of quoting it.
Well, being the entry point of the light, the West Coast, and so every kind of new thing seems to birth in San Francisco, at least.
It does.
I remember it with so much joy, the San Francisco Bay Area, particularly San Francisco, and all of the freedom and innovation and experimentation, for sure, that went on in the late 60s, because that's also my era, early 70s.
Mine too. Yeah.
And it's hard for me to imagine 25 years later how things have evolved there, and a San Francisco that is not, that's still that free, open society that it was at the time.
Well, all of America's been taken over with an obsessive materialism, really. And a kind of, you know, rock rolling down the hill a little bit out of control, where just the necessity to earn money, the demands of working, the amount of money required, just everything is just a little out of balance. I think Yogananda said that by the time the conflicts that we're talking about earlier have hit, that Americans will have much less money, will be much happier. And I just see it, you know, I think people are going to breathe a huge sigh of relief when the whole thing shifts into something on a more human scale. Just the values are so distorted now. But that power that started in the 60s and the 70s is really alive and well. It just, a certain corrective is needed, which Yogananda has promised will come. Babaji has promised it will come. So we're just doing our part in consciousness in the meantime.
Would you say that promise is part of the shift that's happening now?
Oh, yes, I think so. I think so. You mean the promise of difficulties or of uplifted?
Yeah, I think we can speak openly about the difficulties, because people talk about we're going to go into hard times. We're already in them.
Yes, you measure it from those.
Let's be clear about this.
No, I think that's right.
We're in them, and it's getting, day by day, it's getting more and more challenging. Watching people cope or not cope with the pressures that are being brought upon the whole global society.
No, I think
they're emanating first from violence and second from financial fear.
Yeah, I think violence and financial fear, in America at least, though speaking only of this country, you know, we're still, life is pretty normal still. I mean, many people are suffering, and I don't mean to minimize that, but life is going on pretty much in the same pattern. And, you know, I can...
don't you feel that we're sort of at the brink of something?
I've been amazed that it's lasted as long as it's lasted. I looked out the window when I was 10 years old and wondering how it could keep going. You know, that's 50 years now. But there's an intuitive sense of lack of balance, but I think there's been mitigating factors, honestly, because there have been so many people turning to the light. And who knows? It's just...
If we can shift it.
Yeah, who knows? I don't think we can shift it completely. I think simply more is required.
Well, I think that if we look over the field of human experience, the one recurring thing in society and on individual levels is we usually have to take things to the limit. I'm not suggesting that we have to do this, but it appears that we do this. We go to the limit, to the brink, until we activate to respond, to correct the problem.
Well, just look at...
And, for example, if you look at the Earth changes now and global warming, finally it has gotten so bad that people are really, really waking up to this.
It's fascinating the way it works. I mean, I'm always, the way I put it, I'm just so glad it's not, I don't mean to be callous, but it's not really my world. My world is the spiritual world, and I observe the material world. And the material world is created from the spiritual world. It's not, it's a descent from spirit. But look at the microcosm. look at the individual. Individuals in their own tiny sphere of life, people never give up a fixed attitude until they are absolutely persuaded that it's not going to work anymore.
Yes, that was my point.
Yes, and so societally, globally, you see exactly the same thing. I joke about it and say, the goal is to run forward in consciousness because you're so attracted by the light. But if you don't do that, what happens basically is that your backside catches fire and you try to run away from the flames. But the point is to be moving forward. And if you're moving forward already, then you can run ahead of the fire. But if you're not willing to move of your own volition because you're attracted to an expanded awareness, then you will catch fire from behind, because we're not given to stand still. And even fanatical people or people acting out destinies that we don't admire, each within their own sphere, are still making the progress from where they stand. It's just a question, and some are going backwards too. We don't always go forward. Sometimes we go backwards for a long time before we go forward. But everyone is standing on that bubble of consciousness that is the limit of their ability, and the divine force is working in them as wholeheartedly and as completely as it is working in the greatest saint. That's the most profound thing to realize, is that everyone is acting in the same reality, just from whatever level of consciousness is appropriate for them. It puts a whole different picture on the whole thing.
Well, I think that also we are in such an extreme of duality at this time. Extreme dark and extreme light. And it seems that these forces, for sure, in different eras of humanity, have always been pulling and tugging at us. This defines the third dimension. But it seems like now we are at the absolute quintessence of this extreme polarity, and knowing that this shift that we're talking about is the refinement of this.
That's exactly
extreme
right.
Duality.
It is
necessary on certain levels for this to occur in order for us to get to that refinement of it. Am I making any sense at all?
You're making perfect sense. The way Yogananda puts it is, this is the transition between the age of matter and the age of energy. And the age
Indeed.
Of matter is being shattered by the birth of the age of energy. The way Swami Kriyananda put it once, charmingly visual, he said most of the time the humanity is distributed in a shape that would look more like a fat cigar, with a few good people at one end and a few bad people at the other, and most people just kind of hanging out in the middle. The lump of people are just in the middle. He said now the graph would look more like a dumbbell. It's very thin in the middle, and there are many very good people, and there's a great power of light on one end, and there's a great power of darkness on the other, and there's not as much room in the middle anymore. You have to go to one side or the other. And that's what you're talking about, this increasing tension. It's not possible just to remain neutral, because
exactly.
Stresses are too great. You have to choose.
Neutral. And so in this way, from this point of view, it's a very necessary process. And it's very dynamic, and it's very exciting, because we have to move.
I think it's very exciting. That's why I wrote this book about Swami. I felt like he personally, as an instrument of the light, has a tremendous amount to teach us about integrating spirituality into everyday life. Swami Kriyananda's mission, he started communities, not monastic communities like there have been, you know, monks and nuns leaving the world behind, but communities for couples and families, and people with children, and businesses. What we've done is we've tried to take the simple concept, okay, let's say that God realization, devotion to spirit, living in the light is the premise of our existence. Let's build a society based on that premise. And of course, right now it's small. Ananda Village is 900 acres and a few hundred people. It's been there for 40 years. We have schools, we have businesses, we've raised, you know, almost two generations of children there, all on a completely different premise, and we've shown in a very practical way that it works. Another very successful community we have is there in Italy, in Assisi, Italy. We've built...
Where is that? Assisi?
In Assisi. It's 20 miles outside of Assisi, Italy, 20 minutes outside of Assisi. Ananda Europa, it's called. And
how can I get information about that?
Just go right onto the Internet, look up Ananda Assisi, Ananda Europa. and it's a retreat. And that community has played a very interesting role because it's right in Europe, in the heart of Europe, where it's an international it's an example of international divine cooperation. They teach in three languages all the time. And sometimes there's as many as 10 or 12 different languages represented, meaning nationalities. And they serve, you know, Russia, Poland, Hungary, and then all of Central Europe, Portugal, Germany, you know, every country that you can mention there, France, Spain, and they all come together.
How many people are in that society?
That community there is probably about 200 people now. And they,
well, I'm going to have to get up there. It's only 3 hours' drive from Rome, and I did not know that it was there.
Absolutely. And we have also a strong center in Rome, also an Ananda center in Rome, too. And this has been, you know, and these have been the examples of, look, it can be done. This isn't just a theory. This is people living decades of their lives, you know, through hard times, too. It's not by any means like if this has been a cakewalk. In Italy, we have suffered enormously from the society around us. That community has been through some very difficult times in relation to the larger society. Although our attitude is entirely harmonious, we haven't always been regarded that way. But we've just shown that these principles work, that you can apply them to every challenge that life brings you. And in our community here in Palo Alto, we are an urban-based community, so what we did is we took an apartment complex. And we don't own it ourselves, but friends of ours purchased it and leased it to us. And we all live in apartments. But our whole culture of that community, everyone is a meditator. We have a temple. We have a community kitchen where we take some of our meals. Many of the people work for the Ananda Enterprises, but some just work in all their regular societal jobs, but they come back home to the spiritual community. And these these are all examples of, okay, in very, very practical, everyday terms, we can change it. We don't have to just live like strangers. We don't have to just isolate ourselves in the little fort of our own homes. Yogananda used to call that us four and no more, you know, just building a little moat around your family. We can. I like to joke about it. I call it the nation of self-realization, which is this, it goes across all so-called national boundaries, and it doesn't matter what country or what culture you're from. Many of us actually belong to the nation of self-realization. And that's those are our countrymen, just like when Jesus was speaking and they said, your mother and your brother are outside. He said, who is my mother and who is my brother except he who loves God? And that's the unifying reality now.
And I would like to close on that statement. I would like to never close talking with you, but our time is already out, so I would like to remind you all who have had the pleasure of joining us tonight with Asha that we can change the world, we are changing the world, and when you begin to doubt that the light is working, remember these words. Thank you, Asha. It's been fabulous having you on. I hope I can have you back another time.
Anytime. I'd be delighted to talk to you. I very much enjoyed our conversation, too.
And so have I. The book is Swami Kriyananda, As We Have Known Him, by Asha Prabha, available everywhere. And one more time, so I don't make a mistake about your site.
DoorOfMyHeart.com. DoorOfMyHeart.com. And you can get
the book you can
direct.
Get it everywhere, but you're going to want to read this wonderful book. It's a beauty. It's going to definitely be a high priority for you to get it.
Well, thank you.
Give my love to all of the people in your community and my celebrations for the great work you're doing and the peace that you're living with.
And great blessings on the work you're doing. It's been a joy to talk
thank
to you.
Thank you. My love around you, Asha. Thank you for being with us tonight. And that's a wrap, everyone. Please don't forget to come and visit my site, www.syrianrevelations.net. And the good news about the books being released again in the States by North Atlantic Books, pretty soon you'll be able to find them everywhere. And all of the difficulty you've had of every country you've had, problems with finding them will be history. So please spread the word. I need your support. That's it for tonight. I'll be with you next Sunday. Please join in and tell your friends to join us for Beyond the Matrix. Good night.